Without Congress's help, about 16,000 retired miners in 7 states will lose their health care coverage by the end of the year. Congress is considering a proposal to temporarily extend these benefits, but 2 Senate Democrats say it's not enough. They want a more comprehensive plan. To get it, they say they will hold up a spending bill that must pass by tomorrow night to keep the government running. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Kara Lofton reports.
Coal mining is dangerous work, but for many miners, a U.S.-backed promise of benefits and health care for life for you and your dependents made the risk worth it.
When we all started in the mines, we were promised health care for life, cradle to grave.
That's Roger Merriman in Fairmont, West Virginia. He worked in the coal industry for 28 years. The promise he's talking about came about in the 1940s when the United Mine Workers of America and the United States government agreed that union miners who put in 20 or more years would get lifelong pension and health benefits. Patriot is one of 6 major coal producers in the U.S. that have sought bankruptcy protection in the last few years, a process that often comes with trying to shed retiree benefits. Merriman's company, Patriot Coal, filed for bankruptcy in 2012, then again in 2015. Merriman says the looming possibility of losing health benefits is devastating.
We had to make a choice of going to the doctors and buying prescriptions or paying bills and eating. It's a life and death situation, realistically, is what it is.
After the Patriot bankruptcy in 2012, the United Mine Workers of America negotiated a $400 million payment in bankruptcy court for retiree benefits. The UMWA's hope was that money would give Congress time to pass legislation that would protect the miners. But now, those funds are about to run out.
We're asking for a permanent fix. We have a pay for that permanent fix.
That's West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin during a floor speech Tuesday. Senate Democrats have been working for years to pass the Miners Protection Act, a bill that would move money from the Abandoned Mine Lands Reclamation Fund into a fund that pays for the pension and health benefits. But the bill has been met with resistance from Senate Republicans, who are wary of bailing out unionized workers. In return, Manchin and colleague Sherrod Brown of Ohio are trying to block a key spending bill on the Senate floor until miners get their full health care and pension money.
So I haven't ever used this tactic before, but I feel so compelled that I said we're going to do whatever we can to keep this promise.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has proposed a temporary plan, tacking on $45 million to the continuing resolution in front of Congress this week, which will fund the federal government and miners' health care through April 2017. The resolution does not include any money for pensions. Democrats Joe Manchin and Sherrod Brown say they will hold out for a better deal as long as possible, even if it means a brief government shutdown. For NPR News, I'm Kara Lofton in Charleston, West Virginia.
This story is part of a partnership with NPR, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and Kaiser Health News.
It begins with a call that is answered by a regional dispatch.
Hey, Angie, David Mebase. Not a whole lot. Got a patient report for you. An 11-year-old female coming from MedExpress in Fayetteville. Chest pain. Says it feels like a flutter feeling.
The dispatcher then checks to see which teams are closest to the accident or hospital and relays the information to the base. A helicopter gears up with a pilot, flight nurse, and paramedic. The team is wheels up less than 10 minutes after the call.
Yeah, it's the northern part of Green Bar County.
The response teams know nothing about who they are going to pick up or what condition the patient is in until they are in the air.
Look, as you see, we don't have much information right now.
That's so that the team will make the decision to fly or not based on safety, not who is injured. It's tempting to want to push through unsafe flying conditions to pick up a child in respiratory distress, says one paramedic. That policy seems to be working for them. Over 3 decades and 75,000 patient flights, HealthNet has had no accidents while transporting a patient. On a flight on a different day, the team was called to an interstate accident.
On 64, westbound.
They got the interstate shut down. I don't know why they just don't land us right there.
No kidding.
Through the window, miles of traffic are backed up on 64 westbound. As the helicopter turned, we could see why. One semi-truck had rear-ended another. The front end of the second truck looked like a crumpled tin can. We land on the road.
Yeah, we're going to be here for a while.
Yeah, if you want to just shut down, Scotty. Or whatever you prefer on the interstate.
Yeah, we're going to shut down.
On the ground, local emergency medical technicians and firefighters are working to extract the driver from the truck. He is alive and talking, but is bleeding from his head and torso.
Partner, you want to feel the stick? The stick here. Where's she? I'm saying.
No, sir. No, she was relieved to hear that they got you out of the vehicle and they're taking by helicopter. She was really happy to hear
that. Wiggle your feet for me.
Eventually, he is loaded onto the helicopter and flown to Charleston Area Medical Center. The team drops him off, cleans up, and goes back to the base to wait for another call.
But how do you cope with the really hard things, the death of a child? It is a difficulty.
That was Thomas Reed, the flight paramedic, during one of our mid-wait conversations.
You come to the realization, if you have done all that you know to do, that's all that can be asked of you. It's realizing your limitations and what your expectations should be.
Thomas has been with Health Net since it began 30 years ago and has since been on more than 5,000 patient flights, a number almost unheard of in medical flight services. Health Net is owned equally by WVU Medical Center, Charleston Area Medical Center, and Cabell Huntington Hospital.
When it comes to critical care transport, for 30 years, these hospitals have worked together cooperatively to meet the needs of Central Appalachia.
That's HealthNet CEO Clinton Burley. He calls HealthNet's mission altruistic because it's an example of three major medical centers who all want critical patients working together to provide the service to Central Appalachia.
What it means is that we're literally connecting the emergency departments and the intensive care units of our member hospitals out to the far reaches of Appalachia.
Burley says that meant his team has to be extremely well trained to stabilize and manage a patient for long periods of time until they can get to a hospital.
In more urban areas, they have very short transport times. You may have a higher density of population, but your actual time in flight may be very short. It's not uncommon for us to have a patient in a helicopter for 45 minutes or an hour to reach the appropriate medical facility.
But top-of-the-line training and services don't come cheap.
There's no question. Helicopter transport is very expensive, and it's not there for every patient. It wouldn't be out of the question that a patient may have a bill in the neighborhood of $25,000 or $30,000.
By not there for every patient, he means HealthNet wants to fly patients that require the speed of the helicopter and the expert medical crew. If someone can be properly and safely transported on the ground, then that's the way they should be transported so the expensive healthcare assets aren't being misused. If a patient can't pay for the flight, the hospitals absorb the cost as part of what Burley calls an aggressive charity care program.
At the core of the program, when the phone rings, we don't know if someone is a prince or a pauper. They're going to receive the same high level of care regardless of their ability to pay. And we don't know that until way after the patient's delivered at the hospital, which is how it should be.
During the 24-hour shift I spent with Thomas Reed and flight nurse Jason Connor, we had two calls, the one you heard about at the top of the story and a coal mining accident at 2 a.m. When we weren't in the air, we waited. You'd think we'd be bored, but the anticipation of reaction is so strong that even concentrating on a book or writing an article is difficult while one ear is listening for the call.
We can start out at 8 o'clock literally in the morning and start flying. You're going like, oh, this is gonna be a bust day. You're gonna like really rock it and roll it. And then other times, you this is lull and you're like waiting because you know it's gonna break. And then all of a sudden, all the birds are up in the air.
While the three sponsoring hospitals have remained the same, HealthNet has continuously expanded its services over the past 30 years, adding their newest base in Lewisburg in 2015. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedum Foundation.
There are 719 public schools in West Virginia. 129 have school-based health centers, although note that some elementary middle or middle high schools share a center. Just over 30% of those, including Riverside High School and Bell, have mental health services.
I think it's a good thing because a lot of teenagers struggle with it. Like, everybody has a depression or something wrong with them. Like, they think that. And especially in adolescence, the way the brain develops and all that stuff.
That's Lillian Steele Thomas, a senior at Riverside. She has had, as she calls it, a tough life. Over the past 18 years, Lillian has lived with every relative who would take her in. She has also attended 6 or 7 different schools. She is currently living with her boyfriend's parents, the most stable situation, she said, she has had in a while.
Most of the problems, they end up going away after you get older, but some of them, they don't. And getting help young helps you not to have all kinds of horrible issues when you grow up.
Lillian has been diagnosed with depression and anxiety. She is one of 7 students I talked to from 3 schools who have had similar challenges. Most said having a therapist available at school is invaluable. 2 young women from Greenbrier East High School said they wish they had access to one, which they actually do, they just didn't know about it.
For many, many years, there was such a huge focus on academics with No Child Left Behind. So it was all about the test scores. And for many school leaders, they did not see the relationship between mental health and academics. But there are many, many research studies that shows that academics impact mental health and mental health impact academics.
That's Barbara Brady, school counseling coordinator with the West Virginia Department of Education. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 children ages 13 to 18 have or will have a serious mental health condition. West Virginia currently has very little data about the state's childhood mental health, and none that was publicly available. Riverside is Lillian's 2nd high school. The first did not have mental health services. I asked her if having mental health services available at school made any difference to her grades. The short answer, absolutely.
I have good grades now because I can study, but before I couldn't because it wasn't that great. Where I had bad grades, they believed that I wasn't a good student or a good person, but I was telling them I was having a horrible time, told them all kinds of personal things, and they pretty much told me to my face I was lying.
Lillian failed all her classes that first year of high school, except for the 2 that were graded based on participation. She said she thinks she was truant about half the time.
I just didn't feel like going to school anymore. What's the point if nobody cares? And my grades are bad anyway, and it sucks being home, but at least I can, like, go jogging or something, and I can't be in the house.
Being at Riverside, she said, is a world of difference. She feels more supported by both teachers and administrators, who in turn, she said, seem to feel more supported by having referral services available on site. The on-site services also mean she doesn't have to leave school for appointments or make up hours of work. She just shows a teacher her appointment card, then heads down the hall to the clinic waiting room. It's an envelope of support that for most of her life she hasn't gotten from home. Cases like Lillian seem like a success, but administrators like Brady are quick to point out that if schools are not creating an overall better environment for students, placing therapists in schools will not be enough.
It's critical to have those universal preventions, universal support, teaching all students the skills they need to succeed, teaching all students anger management skills, teaching all students conflict resolution skills, social skills, so on and so forth.
The idea is to slowly change the way schools think about mental health and behavioral support. It's not a one-size-fits-all prescription. Schools in Cabell County have very different challenges than schools in McDowell. These schools need to have programs available that they can pick and choose from that work for their school at this time. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedum Foundation.
At Edgewood Summit Retirement Community in Charleston, Mary Mullins, age 93, is waxing eloquent about her geriatrician.
Poor old Dr. Goldberg. There's just so much a person can do, and he's sure got a lot to do and does it so well.
Todd Goldberg is one of just 36 geriatricians in West Virginia, according to the American Geriatric Society. The state needs more than 4 times that many. Goldberg is the medical director of both Mullins Retirement Community and the nursing home we are in now.
With the growing elderly population across America and in West Virginia, obviously we need healthcare providers.
Not only geriatricians, a physician specializing in adults ages 65 and older, he said, but nurses, physical therapists, and psychologists who know how to handle this patient population.
Experts feel that the current workforce is inadequately trained and inadequately prepared to deal with what's been called a silver tsunami, a tidal wave of elderly people increasing in the population of West Virginia, across America, and across the world, really.
The deficit of properly trained physicians is expected to get worse. According to the American Geriatric Society, 1 in 5 Americans will be eligible for Medicare by 2030. Goldberg is also chair of geriatrics at West Virginia University Charleston, home to one of the state's 4 geriatric fellowship programs for medical residents. Geriatric fellowships are required for any physician wanting to enter the field. For the past 3 years, no students have entered the fellowship program at WVU Charleston. In fact, for the past 3 years, no students have enrolled in any geriatric fellowship program in West Virginia.
And this is not just our local program or in West Virginia. This is a national problem.
According to the American Geriatric Society, only 63% of the nation's geriatric fellowship positions were filled in 2014. As Goldberg put it, why would a resident apply to a West Virginia school when even the worst student could get into a program like Yale or Harvard?
We need more geriatricians, but we're not turning out anywhere near enough.
Goldberg says that some young doctors he works with want to go into geriatrics and apply to his program, but that crushing student debt forces them into higher-paying specialties. That trend is of huge concern to West Virginia families.
It's kind of scary that they don't have the care that really they need to help them through these times. So. And help prolong their life and give them a better life.
That's Todd Plumley. His elderly mother has dementia and, quote, a little bit of Alzheimer's. There are no geriatricians in Plumley's hometown, so he or one of his siblings drives their mother almost 45 minutes to Huntington to see a specialist. Plumley said the effort has helped stabilize his mother's symptoms.
Right now, if we didn't have the knowledge and resources that we did have, I believe that my mother would have progressed a lot further along quicker.
Plumley is in his 50s. If trends persist and the field of geriatrics continues to contract, in 20 years, should he need specialized care, driving even 45 minutes may not be an option. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedum Foundation.
If you are the parent of an autistic child in West Virginia, or know someone who is, you might have heard or thought some variation of this refrain.
We can't get sick and we can't die, because who's going to take care of him? You know, what's going to happen to him?
That was Lindsay Reiser talking with me earlier this month. The Reisers are among many families in West Virginia who are struggling to get services for their autistic children. For those of you not familiar with the diagnosis, autism is a spectrum of complex brain disorders characterized by communication difficulties, social and behavioral challenges, and repetitive behaviors. While some of the disability services, both state and private, available in West Virginia are quite good, there's not nearly enough of them. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 1 in 68 children have an autism spectrum disorder. Autism rates can differ widely from state to state, though. In New Jersey, for instance, the rates are 1 in 41, while in South Carolina, the rates are 1 in 81. No mechanism exists to track autism rates in West Virginia.
Hey, buddy.
What's happening?
What's this?
She is sneezing.
Microphone.
Say it loud. Say microphone.
Yeah.
Good job.
Less than 2% of any children or of children with autism receive any evidence-based treatment. So we know that the ability to give these kids the best outcome is really limited by the lack of services.
That's Susanna Poe, director of the Intensive Autism Delivery Clinic at West Virginia University at her Morgantown facility.
Poe says that 2% is an estimate the nonprofit Mountaineer Autism Project came up with after a 2010 survey of West Virginia applied behavior analysis practitioners like herself. To be clear, many ABA practitioners think that ABA is the best method for treating autism, if not the only one. So the 2% is really only referring to kids receiving ABA therapy.
What we find is that the earlier we can identify kids, the more intensely we can involve an individualized one-to-one program, the more kids we will have who will be independent and capable of having lives that are typical of, you know, most any normally developing person.
If early intervention is the key, they're missing that mark.
That's Tom Reiser in Pineville. We heard from his wife, Lindsay, a little earlier. Their 9-year-old son, Ricky, has autism.
Hey, Rick.
For a while, Ricky had been receiving ABA therapy in the Reiser's home. They hoped it would help his speech, behavior, and improve his ability to take care of himself.
So was the applied behavioral therapy helping when he was in it?
No.
I think it helped a little.
Maybe.
I think it helped a little.
Part of the lack of success may be because research has found ABA is only truly effective if it is intensive, a minimum of 20 hours a week, with the gold standard being closer to 40, the kind of program being offered in Morgantown. Ricky was receiving 3 hours a week. Now,
he has services at the school. He gets speech therapy for 30 minutes a week. Occupational therapy, I think it might be 30 minutes to an hour a month. And I don't think there's really any physical therapy. We don't have private insurance. He just has Medicaid.
No applied behavior analysis therapists in the state are currently taking Medicaid or have been able to successfully bill Medicaid. So, when Tom changed jobs and the family lost private insurance, they also lost the ABA therapy.
Oh, Googie!
Here, why don't you get up and show your trampoline or something? Huh? No?
Ricky was watching the credits of Finding Nemo on his iPad when I visited. His mom pointed to a few things in the sparse bedroom they'd found worked well for him. Toys did not.
And this is about a 10-pound blanket. And it compresses, gives him compression on his legs and stuff, and it helps him sleep.
Other objects include a mini trampoline with a bar to hold on to while he bounced, and a fabric hammock swing that Tom says he suspects feels like a hug without arms. Like many kids on the spectrum, Ricky rarely shows physical affection to his family. Jill McLaurie is founder of the ABA facility Bright Futures in Hurricane. She says although the number of board-certified ABA practitioners has more than doubled in West Virginia in the past 5 years, there are still not enough to cover the need. Also, while federal legislation requires that Medicaid cover ABA services, there's so much red tape that most clinics like hers don't bother trying.
To do Medicaid, I would have to be a licensed behavioral health facility. And right now, I've got, again, a waiting list of over 50 families who are private insurance that I'm not able to serve. And so then, from a business perspective, for me to then have to do like a $1,500 application fee to then have to have a lot more scrutiny over how we do the services, it doesn't make sense for me to do that when I'm not able to provide services to the clients who already have funding.
Every West Virginia Autism Center I contacted had a wait list for services.
In West Virginia, even your more populated areas of the state, the families that do have insurance coverage are also still on waiting lists. And so it's absolutely going to be even more significant of a problem in the more rural parts of the state.
Like the Reisers in Pineville, they moved back there from Florida to be close to family who can help them care for Ricky. Both parents have to work. They commute an hour to Beckley to keep the family financially afloat. But there are no ABA services available to them in Pineville, or even in Beckley, the closest metropolitan area. Even if there were, they don't have the insurance to cover it, and wait lists can be years long. Also, many groups prioritize giving services to younger children, ages 2 to 3, versus school-age children like Ricky because ABA is most effective the earlier it started. So, what happens to families like the Reisers?
He was out of control.
He was being more aggressive. And
despite being on Risperdal, which is supposed to be for aggression. So we were at a wit's end because we didn't know whether he was going to be able to go to public school or not. So then you're like, well, what are we going to do beyond that?
So the Risers, desperate, decided to try something different. They made an appointment at Autism Health in Beckley, a clinic that focuses on the relationship between poor gut function and autism symptoms like poor sleep patterns, diarrhea, and aggression. They said they were pretty skeptical of the clinic at first, but it got to the point that...
So we were like, okay, you know, we'll try anything pretty much.
Janet Lintela is the founder of the clinic. She said she sees kids like Ricky come into her office all the time.
They can't sleep. They're constipated. They have acid reflux. They're in quite a bit of discomfort and pain, but no, they can't tell anyone that because most of them don't have their language. And so how they tell us that is through irritability and difficult behaviors. And that's what ends up getting medicated. We all see the difficult behaviors. The doctors go, here's an antipsychotic, and that painful underlying condition remains unaddressed. It's just like a merry-go-round they can't get off of.
Lintela, a chiropractor by training and mother of an autistic child, prescribes a combination of digestive enzymes, probiotics, antifungals, improved diet, and hyperbaric oxygen therapy to her patients. Lintela says she does not take a salary at her clinic and provides an angel fund for families unable to access her services. For Ricky, it's really effective.
His bowels regulated before he was either stopped up or going 4 or 5 times a day. So just the relief that he gets with the enzymes, just for his bowels alone, is worth the price of admission.
Ricky is also sleeping better and has become less aggressive to the point that he was able to be taken off of his anti-aggression medication, Risperdal. The Rissers are quick to point out that their son still has autism. This isn't a cure, nor are they trying to cure him.
All that we can do is, you know, give him some therapies and try to help him regain his speech or, you know, whatever physical problems he might be having and try to ease his symptoms, but you're never going to cure him.
In a follow-up email, I asked Tom why they didn't take Ricky to a gastrointestinal specialist. Tom said they didn't realize the gastrointestinal issues were such a huge problem. It wasn't until they went to Autism Health that someone made the connection. It's worth noting that Lintela is very supportive of ABA therapy, saying that what she does is scientifically proven to be low risk and accomplishes completely different goals than ABA. ABA therapists like Jill McLaurie are more critical of Lintela, urging patients to consider their resources and time carefully when deciding which therapies to pursue. But the Risers are very complimentary of Lintela's clinic. They say they notice huge regressions during periods they're not able to afford the enzymes, which cost around $40 a bottle and last about a month. Despite improvements, they continue to hope for more therapy in general, which they think is most likely to come through the state intellectual and developmental disabilities waiver program. The Intellectual Developmental Disabilities Waiver Program is awarded to West Virginians who have a documented intellectual and/or developmental disability. 4,634 people are on the waiver, the maximum allowed, and more than 1,000 are on the wait list. The average time between when a person is approved for the IDD waiver program and when they receive a slot is a little over 3 years.
If these children need this waiver and need the support, then where is the immediacy? Because right now my child is behind. He grows more and more behind every day. If this is an early intervention, something that is only remedied by early intervention, where is the immediacy in the waiver? Why is it taking 3 years? 3 years to get my child into this program? That's a little extreme.
The waiver provides a plethora of services for families, including direct care services, day services, respite services, and behavior management services. Legislators have considered cutting funding to it. But in a written statement, the DHHR says that despite historic budget challenges, every effort is being made to protect the current level of funding allocated by the legislature for the waiver. In the meantime, Ricky is in third grade, special education.
Sometimes, his parents admit, they wonder if his classes are just glorified babysitting. The therapy he receives through school just doesn't seem to be enough. So, you might be wondering, what happens when a child does get the services they need? Well, they might look like Hope.
Ready?